Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be meeting New England folk horror revivalist Robert Eggers to learn more about his bonkers new film, The Lighthouse.
Then we'll be heading to New York City for a chat with soulful pop singer OK Kaya.
And we'll be learning about the interwar life of a Bloomsbury square as we meet author Francesca Wade.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Wow. Not only... We started last week very strongly with you, Tom, doing the news look ahead. You've only upped the game to the max.
We've changed through the gears.
Yeah.
Pedal is to the metal, Rob. That's how we roll.
What an honour and privilege it is to share the studio with you this Sunday lunchtime. Just for the listening several, how's the year going?
I'd say it's a robust start.
Yeah.
Can I tell you what I'm fed up with, Rob?
Oh.
I'm fed up with the virtue signalling of dry January, veganuary, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I know we're nearly out of January, thank heavens.
Yeah.
Stop telling me about it. I want to have a big bloody steak, possibly every day, with a box of wine to go with it.
A box of wine.
And that's before noon.
Okay.
On a weekday.
But we're fine because this is noon on Sunday. So where are we at in your kind of dining, in your food and drink day?
I'm just bringing that box of wine to room temperature.
I heard something sloshing around underneath the radio desk.
I like the idea of some New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
A clarity of vision for the year ahead. But, you know, I need a large amount of drink to do that.
Okay, I like that. Putting the claret into clarity. That's kicked off the show, I think, in the spirit very much in which we mean to go on. But it's missing one vital ingredient. Who is that peering handsomely through the glass?
Oh, it's Fernando. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright. Fernando. Here he is, Fernando, returning to his regular look ahead spot. You look refreshed, Fernando. I know you've been back for a few days, but you've been in the motherland. Treated you well?
Very well. And in fact, it made me feel very positive. All my stories on today's news look ahead, they're kind of positive. So there's no negativity here, and I'm not going to be impartial. It's all the things that I like.
Wow.
In one way or another. Let's start today, right? Today's Sunday, the last day of Men's Fashion Week in Paris, which, you know, it's one of the most exciting ones. Of course, Milan, you know, is a good competition to it. But, you know, if you still have time, there's still some shows to watch. Today, there's Lanvin, Craig Green, and Acne as well. And I have to say, Acne is one of those brands. It's my go-to brand. You know, if I need a pair of jeans, if I need a sweater, I think they are quite reliable in that sense. Paris is not only about Men's Fashion Week. Tomorrow, the haute couture shows are starting in the city. So it's quite an exciting period for Paris, always. Like Men's Fashion Week, straight followed by haute couture shows as well.
I love that. That brands of the size of Lanvin are mere hors d'oeuvres before the haute couture shows, right?
And I love that the haute couture shows are still going on. A lot of people say one of those tired articles, are haute couture shows too relevant? Of course they are. You know, there's still a massive market for that. And it's all about what we here at Monocle like, you know, all the craft. We've been talking a lot about this in 2019 and I'm sure 2020 as well.
Strength, power to haute couture's incredibly skillful elbow, Faye.
Absolutely. And you know, another place where they need a lot of skillful people as well, the world of cinema. And of course, is the Oscar season everybody's talking about. But some film festivals already, starting with Sundance Film Festival, which starts on the 23rd of January in Utah, as usual. It's been going on for more than 30 years. And the interesting thing about Sundance, of course, it's the great place for the smaller indie films. But I like it because, you know, some very small films, they can get, you know, a lot of great deals. Last year, you got The Farewell. They had a $6 million deal. Mm-hmm. And Late Night, the Emma Thompson comedy, which got, I think, a record-breaking number, $40 million. So I very much look forward to see which films, can get a good deals and good distribution, because that's how we're going to watch all those amazing films. Because if there's no distribution, we're probably not going to see them anytime soon.
Yeah, it's a great barometer, Sundance, still, right? And I covered the festival once for Monocle, for a magazine story, and the hotels during Sundance are just amazing. There's good parties going on downstairs, but all the deals are being done upstairs. People running in and out from room to room with sheafs of paper, almost briefcases full of cash. It's almost, you could make a great film about the Sundance Film Festival, actually. Quite good skiing, too.
That'll be a great, and you can debut at the Sundance Film Festival
exactly,
as well.
Exactly, exactly.
And if you ask me about which films are we looking forward, it's very difficult to say because, you know, it didn't start it yet as mm-hmm. well. But one thing I noticed about some of the titles, I mean, we've seen in 2019 films like Bombshell, which are talking about, you know, sexual harassment in this kind of post-Harvey Weinstein era. There's a lot of films about that, including The Assistant, which talks about an assistant that works for one of those media moguls and all sorts of things happen. The new Carey Mulligan comedy, Promising Young Woman, which is kind of a black comedy in a way, if you think about it. So a lot of interesting titles there in Sundance this year.
Nice.
But after fashion and cinema, you know what's my third topic? Something that I love very much and one of my favorite things about the UK, in fact,
Speedos.
As well. Well, not quite.
Even though it's the wrong season.
Something for next week. I'll find a story with Speedos. But again, on the 23rd of January, is the National Fish and Chip Award in London.
Ooh, okay.
Very traditional. Okay. And they have a lot of categories. So it's not only the best fish and chip restaurant. It's the best takeaway, the best new restaurant. It's like the Oscars of fish and chips, generally. And last year, winner was a place called Crispy's in Exmouth, in Devon. I love fish and chips. I think they're quite magical in some ways. And it's very, I mean, some people say they taste the same. I don't think so. We're lucky that our office is close to the Golden Hind, which they have an excellent.
Very good.
And the shellfish is not too far away on Lisson Grove.
Excellent. Do you enjoy a good fish and chip, perhaps, on a weekend?
Absolutely.
Fernando,
I grew up in Muswell Hill, where we had Toffs, which is still going. Absolutely top draw. And there's another one up in Finchley, I think Two Brothers.
Yeah.
Amazing. So wherever you are in London, now Walthamstow, there's loads of the really old school ones.
It's super good stuff. And what about you, Faye? How do you take your fish and chips?
Well, you know, for me, the chips are very
main
important.
Event.
Yeah. I quite like this kind of very old fashioned, slightly kind of oily, these big mm-hmm. fat chips. You know, that I don't like when people try to make them kind of skinny.
Not a fry.
Oh God!
Fish and chips. Come on, man.
But I've seen this quite a lot here in London as well, in bad places.
Give me the addresses. I'll go around there.
Well, sort them out.
Yeah.
I give you very briefly because we have the finalists as well.
Oh, go on.
Okay.
Neither of them are in London, but it's Fish City in Belfast, Something Else Fishy in Dorset, the Cod Scallop in Nottinghamshire,
sorry,
the Fisherman's Wife in North Yorkshire, and the Trenchant Restaurant in Tyne and Wear.
Okay, nice. Some punning titles. A good thing with fish and chip shops is often they're punning titles. We used to have the Tasty Place. In Petworth, in
good.
Sussex.
In Cod We Trust.
In Cod We Trust, always. The Codfather.
Codfather.
Always good. Three things that Faye loves. I love all the three of those things. Tom?
Yes, 100%.
It's another brilliant news look ahead. Fernando, thank you very
thank
much
you.
Indeed.
Yes, thanks indeed, Fernando. This is the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be learning why texture and authenticity can brook no compromise as we meet the director, Robert Eggers. Robert Eggers broke onto the scene, or perhaps descended on a broomstick, with his 2015 debut, The Witch, a film unlike any other. It took the New England frontier and the bogeyman of the past and created a haunting, claustrophobic portrait of a family pushed to and beyond its limits.
Now Eggers is back, once more exploring the effects of isolation at the edge of civilization. His new film, The Lighthouse, draws on two bravura performances from Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson and an almost pathological attachment to archaic methods of film production to create a salty old sea dog saga so crusted in brine you can almost smell it through the screen.
Monocle's Augustin Macellari sat down with Robert to learn more about the film and to ask why it's the horrors of folklore rather than the spooks of the screen that so capture his interest. Aug began by asking what it is about life on the frontier that so intrigues the director. But first, here's a clip of the film.
Tell me, what's a timberman want with being a wiki?
Just looking to earn a living, just like any man. Starting new.
On the run. Keeping secrets, are you?
No, sir.
Watch you spill your beans.
On a practical level, if you're making a movie like in an isolated and single location, it's cheaper. But I mean, the thing is that when you're in a situation like that, people get into ecstatic, positive or negative emotional states, and that's interesting. And we can see the dark underbelly of what it is to be a human being, which is interesting.
It definitely is. I mean, in those situations, you know, where does the supernatural fit into that? Is that a kind of catalyst for this sort of this ecstatic turn that these people experience?
I mean, I just like religion, mythology, folktales, fairy tales, at times the occult. It's just what I'm interested in, and it's what moves me. So likely all of the work that I'm going to do is going to be exploring that stuff. And so if the characters believe in it, whether it's real or not, whatever reality means, but if they believe in it, it's real. And so, yeah, I mean, the witch is a catalyst for despair in The Witch, and the supernatural elements in The Lighthouse are meant to be ambiguous. Is it in Rob's head or is it in the light?
I wanted to ask you about that ambiguity. Why did you kind of make this decision? I know that some people have read The Witch as having its own ambiguity. For me, I cheerfully took it at face value. It was a thrill to see The Witch kind of revealed in the early moment. It was no less of a thrill to watch this film, I don't want to spoil it, where as you say, there is this ambiguity. Why did you kind of shift towards that?
I don't know. I wanted to make a slightly obscure movie for whatever reason. And I also just felt for what the, like, I frankly, like, whether that's good or not, like, that's an intention that I came into making the movie with. So we were trying to honor that. It's a tightrope, and I don't know if it's always successful. I mean, we have certain things that are really, really, really on the nose. Like, the movie is vulgar and juvenile, and some of the visual symbolism is embarrassing, but we're making big choices and we're sticking to them. But, you know, when we have certain, like, genre tropey moments that we hammer down on, Bad Luck to Kill a Seabird couldn't be more obvious and direct and clear, and it's set up, it's got a payoff, and we have these kinds of things so the audience can hold on to those and then be led astray by all these other ambiguities that we've placed to kind of knock people off balance. Like, there are lines of exposition important as Bad Luck a Seabird that are deliberately photographed and blocked in a way that you might be left behind, and then you're having to play catch up. That's our intention, that's our hope. And so far, in the warm arms of film festival cinephiles, like, we're mostly being embraced and people are kind of understanding our intentions and going with them, which is cool. Again, because the film's so ridiculous, I thought it would be more divisive thus far, and perhaps when it gets released for more average everyday audiences, like, we'll get some more boos and hisses. But, you know, just trying to take some chances, I guess.
You mentioned that it's very juvenile. It is. It's really puerile. It's very bawdy. It's also very beautifully written. It must have been a lot of fun to do. I was thinking some of the language, some of the speeches, especially that Willem Dafoe kind of comes out with, are great. They're just really entertaining. I was reading that you got some of the dialogue from researching writing from around that time, and I know that the process was similar with The Witch. What does that kind of research, you know, beyond the linguistic, does it open anything else up for you in terms of the decisions you're going to make in the movie itself?
I mean, obviously I have to put my own personal experiences and feelings into this movie, or it does not, like, into any work, or it doesn't have life and it's not honest. But my approach is so thoroughly research based, you know, every single, like, because I didn't live in a lighthouse in the 19th century. So I have to learn tons about it. So my brother who wrote this with me, you know, we were reading everything we could get our hands on, and I was collecting thousands and thousands of images from the period to create the material world specifically. We build every building, including the working 70-foot lighthouse tower. in the film, you know, to period specifications, although the table that they sit and have dinner at is maybe a little bit exaggeratedly tiny in order to shoot a two shot on a 50 millimeter lens, like with our boxy aspect ratio. But yeah, I mean, it's all connected. The, you know, like looking at Moby Dick again for turns of phrase, you're lost in the world of Melville, and that becomes influential, and Melville and Coleridge and other writers who turn to classical mythology brings that into mind when we're doing this nautical mythological world, even though like it's sort of, you know, Atlantic folklore of Maine and of settlers from the British Isles and stuff. But then when you get into the classical mythology, you start looking at symbolist painting, and symbolist painting can influence a scene, a moment, an image. We're drawing from everything happily and joyfully. But I think with the text and the physical world, when they're really grounded and based on fact, it gives a credibility to mermaids and sea monsters.
Yeah, I quite agree. I mean, is that your background in set work that's kind of brought you to that? This is one of the more atmospheric films I've ever seen, really. I kind of felt like I had a cold when I left the cinema. Is that professional experience elsewhere that's kind of brought you towards that you can't kind of synthesize this sort of world if you want it to have integrity?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, having a production design background helps me to work with my collaborators and more specifically like articulate my intentions. I think I always would have been wanting to do stuff like this, because it was always period movies, sometimes science fiction as a kid, that really excited me. And so being in these other worlds, and then when I was like 16, like seeing City of the Lost Children, you know, that kind of detail and texture was appealing to me before I had any clue on how to pull it off myself. Obviously, that's a created world, not a recreated world, but, you know, of course, beautifully well done. But, you know, atmosphere, it's the sets, it's the location, it's the weather, it's very much the photography. The film stock that we're using hasn't changed since the 1950s. We use an orthochromatic filter, which basically is not sensitive to red light, but is sensitive to other colors of light and ultraviolet. So that, you know, in early photography, part of the reason why people look so bad is because it was orthochromatic film. So you're seeing blemishes and things from like 20 years previous, and like on Caucasian skin tones, like any of the rosiness in the face goes dark. If you watch like an Eisenstein movie, the reason why all those Russians look so tan is because of their orthochromatic film stock. And the other silent movies, people are putting white pancake makeup on their face to like make up for that. But that orthochromatic stuff, shooting on lenses from as early as 1905, all that stuff, like with the period correct buttons and with the dirt underneath their fingernails and with the fact that they grew their own facial hair and the sound of the text and then the soundscape of the film, and making sure that, you know, we spend enough time that every single object in there sounds like it's the most rusty, dusty, crusty, musty, broken down thing possible. That's all accumulating to like hopefully leaving you smelling the movie.
Yeah, it definitely does. I wanted to just come back round to Maine, to the East Coast of America. What draws you to that sort of region? It's the oldest part of the modern United States. It has this rich kind of mythology that at times, you know, the folklore and the fiction from it are kind of indistinguishable. You know, it has this veneration, certainly in upstate New York, for Washington Irving. Sleepy Hollow is kind of practically a myth, even though we know who wrote it. Mm-hmm. What draws you to that, to the landscape and to the kind of, I suppose, the psychic landscape as well of the place?
As I said, like, you know, folklore and mythology and all that stuff is what I love the best. And this is the region I grew up in. And again, talking about personal experiences and bringing like your own background into the work that you do, that's partially how to make it honest. So both of these films are kind of explorations of the folk culture of my past. And I think, you know, New England, there are like these rich traditions, and there are like the Pilgrim Fathers, as they call them here, and like all the Revolutionary War characters. When you grow up in New England, like, they kind of lean into that stuff, but the folklore, not as much. You have to seek it out a bit. And the folk culture isn't as pronounced in New England as it is, say, like in Texas. You know, they have a folk culture that's like American folk culture that people know and recognize. And as a New Englander, you have to search harder to find it, I think.
Is there something in this kind of folkloric bogeyman, rather than something that's, you know, been knocked around so many times in modern culture that it's kind of lost, you know, it's lost its grip on what it was around the campfire? Is there something, you know, whether it's a witch or a siren, that kind of appeals to some sort of more atavistic fear? Is there something, do you think, deeper and more kind of organic about the responses those figures provoke in the imagination?
Carl Jung would say yes, and my brother and I both, for better or for worse, have some Jungian leanings. So I think, yeah, I mean, that's part of what I like about the past, is kind of connecting to forgotten things and feeling, you know, hit in the gut by something that was rattling around in my unconscious, we'll say, and having it sort of resurface again. And, you know, for whatever reason, the witch hit at a time when in the zeitgeist, like, that archetype was reconstellating herself in society at large. And like, and it's gotten us to the point where like Sabrina the Teenage Witch is like a phenomenon, and like, and it's all very pop culture. And in the years preceding the witch, there was, you know, like witch house electronic music and haute goth fashion. And I'm not like, I'm like, oh, like, I'm going to follow that because it's popular. But it's just, as much as I love the past and try to stay locked inside it, I don't live in a vacuum. And myself, I'm also like influenced by the zeitgeist, because you can't not be. With The Lighthouse, you know, I don't write with any messages or intentions. I just, as I said, I had an atmosphere. I wanted to make a lighthouse movie. With The Witch, I wanted to make a witch movie. I had an atmosphere I wanted to articulate. But, you know, of course, when you look at what's going on here, nothing good happens when two men are trapped in a giant phallus. And I think that, as we're terming it now, like, toxic masculinity is important thing to take a look at, even though, you know, more female-centric movies are needed.
That was Robert Eggers talking to Augustin Macellari, and Robert's new film, The Lighthouse, will be released in the UK on Friday, the 31st of January. Right now, you are with The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time for some new music now, Tom. We'll be hearing from Kaya Wilkins, a.k.a. OK Kaya, in just a second. She made waves with her cover of Believe, the Cher banger. It's been a while, but let's revisit the original. And remember, the first time we ever heard the now ubiquitous auto-tune in action.
Take issue, Rob, with your words, time now for some new music.
Yeah, I don't quite know.
That was some fairly old music.
That was some...
You said banger. I'll second
it. It's definitely a banger. It feels new every time you listen to it. It's probably what I meant.
Believe, for sure. Quiz question. When was that from then? I don't know the answer, so this is a bit of an open-ended one.
I think it's 2000.
Oh, does that make you feel old? It certainly makes me feel
makes
old.
Makes me feel pretty old, yeah.
I mean, everything does. That box of wine I mentioned earlier...
How's your clarity? How's your clarity,
it's,
New Year?
It's fading fast. But that was Believe by Cher. I mean, as if I needed to.
As if you needed to reiterate that.
On the Monocle Weekly.
Kaya Wilkins is a Norwegian-American musician working under the moniker OK Kaya. She debuted her soulful, introspective songs on her 2018 album, Both, and her follow-up, Watch This Liquid Pour Itself, comes out this week on Jag Jaguar.
Wilkins spoke to Henry Reese Sheridan in her apartment in New York's Greenpoint neighbourhood.
Sexual well-being, sex with me is mediocre, but I can probably feel what you're feeling.
I grew up on a peninsula outside of Oslo, Norway, called Nesoddtangen. In hindsight, it was a great place to grow up. It's really beautiful. It's just surrounded by the Oslo fjord. I grew up with my mom and my brothers in a little olive green house. And I don't know how we got into what we were doing. Basically, my mom's a painter and she listened to a lot of music and sort of influenced us all to become musical in a way, me and my brothers. And so we did, I guess, eventually.
And Oslo was the place that you went to get up to adolescent hijinks.
Yeah, there's this one, once we were all like in our teens, me and my older brothers, we would go to the squat house to watch like punk DIY shows and drink beer, even though we were underage. That's like my first venture into like a scene, I guess.
You arrived in New York like 10 years ago, is that right?
Yeah. I moved here because my dad's American, and so I'm born in New Jersey, fun fact. And I was able to get a passport and move over here, so I just did. I was 19 and didn't have anything else going on, really. I had assigned to a modeling agency here, and I was just trying my luck, I guess. In retrospect, I have no idea why I did any of those things, but I'm really kind of happy I did. It's like that weird teenage fearlessness where you just don't know anything, so you're just like, well, gotta do that. But I moved and was really broke, had no friends, had no jobs for about a year and a half, and that's when I started making music. The reason why I called the album this exact title is because there is a YouTube video called Watch This Liquid Pour Itself, which I might bury now with all this press, but if you Google it really quickly after this, you might be able to find it, and it's just like a science video of a substance, liquid, called polyethylene glycol, I think. And yeah, it's a beautiful video. You know, when you just you see yourself in objects or things. I just saw myself in that video. To me, it's like the most beautiful video of all time. It's like a 30-second science video.
You got to explain what happened in the video.
Basically, what are those things called? Basically, it's just like a liquid pouring itself out of a cup. It's beautiful. It's blue. You see it sort of just blah, like rolling over the edge. That's it. It's just like, yeah, a really short science project. But this album, I was actually focusing on liquids that are on the inside of the human body. So I was kind of focusing on the four humors in Greek medicine, There's black bile and there's yellow bile and then there's blood and then there's... I can't remember the last one, but they all represent different sort of... like they all need to be in balance. If not, yeah, all hell breaks loose for one's emotions or psychological health.
Healthcare and health in general is a kind of recurring trope or motif in your work, both your solo work and some other projects that you've done. There's a song on your upcoming album which just means healthcare in Norwegian.
Helsevesen.
What's that one about?
That one is actually about bleeding through my favorite pajamas and my period cycle. Just a day in the life of, I go down to the laundry, I say, hey, I bled through my favorite pajamas. Could you help me, like, get the stains out? But the title of the song directly means healthcare, but if you chop up the two words, there's the word health, and then vesen actually could mean creature. So if you were to separate those things in Google Translate right now, you might get health creature. That's why I found it interesting for that particular song as a title.
Do you find that being able to write and sing bilingually in Norwegian and English significantly kind of enhances or maybe shapes your artistic expression?
I think it's really interesting writing songs in Norwegian, but with an audience in mind that don't speak the language. And so I try to do that, actually, where I try to juxtapose the production or maybe the feeling or melody of the song with what the actual lyrical theme is. And so you can sort of listen to something, and Norwegian is quite a sing-songy language, and it sounds quite beautiful when it's sung. Not as beautiful as Swedish, but close. And I'll lift the pills that
take me through the process of recording and writing this latest album.
I mean, I signed to a record label called Jag Jaguar last year, and they had some really great ideas of like who I could collaborate with or who would mix the record and so forth. So it's been a really cool collaborative process from start to finish. Some songs I recorded in LA with John Kirby, who's an amazing person. And then I finished off the record by additional production and mix by Jacob Portrait, who has a studio like a block away from here. So that was an interesting process to sort of invite people into shaping the bile with me. Also sharing the same sensibilities. I just had a really good time. People have asked me if my sophomore album was trickier to release or trickier in the process or something, but it actually was like, yeah, every day was just exciting and inspiring. And now I just want to make another one.
Your music's pretty intimate and kind of quite quiet. How do you find performing that live?
It's been tricky. I'm just getting used to it, even though it's not my go-to idea of fun. But it's really special when I get to actually connect with people and there's like this energy in the room. Yeah, it can be really rewarding and cool and interesting, but most of the time I'm terrified. This record around, I'll have a band, which is really great. They're these amazing musicians. And so being up there with them sort of changes the whole thing. And even though there's my music is quite quiet, there's kind of a lot of stuff going on in terms of production, just a lot of layers and things. Also, if everything's like energies and vibes and shit, man, then just being on a stage with people who are creating these amazing melodies and providing, yeah, they're just providing a different thing.
Blow your nose gently. You shouldn't ever feel pain. You could try wiggling. You could could try swallowing this end and try again.
And there's one song on this album in particular which is inspired by a scuba diving experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I sometimes act, I suppose, which has been a really crazy experience. But I actually was supposed to be in this scuba diving movie that I was really excited about. Like, I got the part, everything was all good, and I did my first scuba diving lesson, and it turns out that I can't scuba dive because I have inner ear problems. But I had read like all the theory and like got so prepared and like, you know, gotten into this part. It was like, it was insane. And so it was pretty disappointing to hear from a doctor that I couldn't actually do it. So what I did was just think about all that theory and figuring out how to use it. And it just sounds like a manual for how to not have a panic attack, basically. And that is also what you're supposed to not do underwater is panic. Yeah, I just took it, man. I'm just interested in like, how do I make this thing feel like something else? And I think that's like classic sublimation thing that people do when they make things, and I'm really interested in that process, and it does really give my life meaning. So I guess I'm gonna do that for the rest of my life.
That was Kaya Wilkins, a.k.a. OK Kaya, speaking to Henry Rhys Sheridan. Watch This Liquid Pour Itself is out on January the 24th. You are with The Monocle Weekly.
In the early 20th century, Mecklenburg Square in London's Bloomsbury wasn't the multi-million postcode it is today. Tucked away near the British Museum, the square was home to poor families, rogues, and, as it turns out, a handful of the century's most daring female writers.
Author Francesca Wade's new book, Square Haunting, Five Women, Freedom and London Between the Wars, uses the square and the women who lived and worked there, amongst them Virginia Woolf, to explore the context and struggles of female intellectuals in the early 20th century.
Monocle's culture editor Chiara Rimella sat down with Francesca to learn more.
Well, it's Mecklenburg Square, which is out on right on the eastern edge of Bloomsbury. And yeah, I've lived in London all my life, but I hadn't heard of Mecklenburg Square. It's not really a place that you pass through because it doesn't sort of lead to other places and it's quite isolated. It's separated from the better known squares of Bloomsbury by Coram's Fields, which you can only go into if you're accompanied by a child. I studied the poet HD at university, so I knew her work already and I knew that there was a blue plaque to her in Mecklenburg Square, so I did a special detour getting lost along the way to find it and was kind of amazed by this square, which is still pretty residential. The garden is locked and so you can only kind of glimpse in through the really high hedges. But I was intrigued by this place and read about it online later and discovered that not only had Virginia Woolf lived there, it was her last London home. HD had lived there during the First World War and I discovered that Woolf had lived there during the Second World War. And then I realised there were several other women writers whose names, some of them I knew, some of them I didn't, had all lived in the same place. So I sort of started to wonder what had brought them all there, and was it purely a coincidence or was there something about the area or about these figures that had drawn them all together?
Well, we'll get onto that later, whether it was a coincidence or whether there was something in the area that kind of made it particularly appealing for them to all converge there. And obviously there is an answer to that. But I'd like to kind of keep talking about this idea of the anonymity of the place, because in the book you mention a few times that it was Virginia Woolf's own intention at some point to write a record, a history of the anonymous women, the women that have kind of gone unnoticed in the past. And in the square, there is a statue to a woman that she used to particularly love. And this is the story of five women, some of whom have really quite been forgotten by history. Mm. What is the importance of this idea of bringing something that's kind of right under our noses back to life?
Mm. Well, yeah, this idea was something that really drove the writing of the book. Virginia Woolf's essay, A Room of One's Own, was really important to me already. And then as I started to think about what had drawn these women together, I thought about it a lot more. And in that book, she writes very movingly about the way that women are not only not really represented in history books, but also aren't represented in the way that cities look. And she describes particularly walking around London and saying that, you know, if you look at the city, you wouldn't know that many women had lived there or lived important lives there, because what is commemorated in London's landscape is generally as, you know, huge statesmen looking with sort of long beards looking important. But she absolutely loved this unassuming statue, which is on Guildford Place, which is at the bottom of Lambs Conduit Street in between Mecklenburg Square and Brunswick Square. You can see the entrance to Mecklenburg Square from the statue. She just thought it was a kind of apparition of an anonymous woman. I mean, she does have a name, which you can research. She's the woman of Samaria, a sort of biblical story. And I find her very moving, because at the time that she was built there, the Foundling Hospital opposite was an orphanage, and so women for many years since it was founded would come there and leave their babies in a basket on the gate, and you left them there with a token so that if you were ever in a position to reunite, you'd recognise each other. So many women who have been forgotten to history have made a journey to almost to Mecklenburg Square for that reason, and so I feel like this woman, this statue, was a sort of emblem of that kind of lost past, lost London history that isn't known about.
So speaking of lost London history and forgotten people, we should really mention the names of the five women who are at the heart of this book and whose biographies you kind of unpacked, even though this is not a traditional biography, but you kind of talk about them as they come and go from the square. Who are they? And how did you find out about them? And what kind of excited you about their lives?
Well, the idea of the book was they didn't all know each other. It's not a kind of Bloomsbury group. They all lived at the square at different points during the World Wars. And I wanted to put their lives together by writing a chapter about each of them during the time that they happened to live in Mecklenburg Square. Only one of them lived there for a long time, Eileen Power. The others lived there only for a few years. But I think for each of them, moving to the square was a kind of moment of self-definition or of transition in their lives. The poet H.D. moved there during the First World War, which was a really traumatic time in her personal life as well as in, you know, wider life. She moved there with her husband, who was very soon called up and went away to fight and came home and had an affair with the upstairs lodger. The house was a sort of hotbed of horror for H.D., who was trying to work on her poetry and her translation. But yeah, it was kind of subsumed into this domestic drama, which she really spent the rest of her life trying to work through. She had analysis with Freud in the 1930s to recover from a period of writer's block. And also, as the rise of fascism was happening, she was trying to fortify herself for the idea that there was going to be a Second World War, because the First World War had been so traumatic for her. And Freud told her that he could see that this period during the First World War was so crucial to her sense of herself, but that she blocked it out, that really she needed to go back and process it. So she really spent the rest of her life writing about these years. So even though it wasn't a very long period, it was very important to her sense of who she was. The second one, Dorothy Sayers, moved into the very same room that H.D. left 3 years later. She was one of the first women to graduate from Oxford, who had passed a new statute allowing women degrees in 1920. So she was in the first graduation ceremony. I mean, this is another reason why the interwar period is so fascinating to look at, because it was such a time of change. And these women who, with one exception, the women in this book were born towards the end of the 19th century and were growing up into a world where there were new possibilities that just wouldn't have been really open to their mothers in the same way, which was very exciting, but also, I think, quite daunting. And so Dorothy Sayers arrived there knowing that she wanted to be a writer, but not really having any guarantee that that was going to be a success. So during the year that she spent in Mecklenburg Square, she was working on her first detective novel. And nowadays, I mean, Dorothy Sayers' detective Lord Peter Wimsey is, you know, totally beloved, and her books are very much still in print, and she has really devoted following. But at this time, she was struggling for money. She was in a difficult relationship with an older man, also a writer, who really didn't think that her crime fiction was worth much. And so she was amazingly kind of resolute in her determination to live the kind of life that she wanted. And so the story of her chapter is really the story of how she kept going and persevered. and to some extent managed it with some serious sacrifices along the way.
Well, we come back to the idea of having a room of one's own in which to write in this book, and obviously that was true at the time, because for these women kind of striking out and trying to write and trying to make a living out of writing in these houses and these flats they were renting was particularly hard. But what do you think it means now? Do you think women still need a room of their own? Is it still relevant?
I think it is still relevant. I mean, I think it worked so well for this book as a sort of metaphor, because within Wolf, not only is it a literal room, she says, you know, you need space, which, and, you know, that entails needing money to pay the rent or whatever. But I think also the room of one's own is metaphorical. I mean, it's the ability to have the conditions that you need to work under, and whether that is a supportive relationship or, you know, to be part of a community or an institution that is supportive and that tells you that you can do it. And all of the women in this book were working out what they needed and what kind of compromises they could put up with and what they just couldn't. It's moving and fascinating to see the different ways they've all answered the same questions, which we're still very much asking today. I mean, we talk about, you know, how to combine family and work life, for example, and that's something that all of these women thought about very deeply.
Something that we alluded to earlier is the reason why all of these women converged to the square. And there's a very interesting passage in which you say it was almost an accident of architecture that Bloomsbury became what it was, because it was actually, as a neighbourhood, designed for a completely different purpose. And then in some way or another, it actually became almost a female neighbourhood. And not that many people perhaps know that Bloomsbury has this kind of history. Did that surprise you? The history of this neighbourhood that right now we're used to thinking of as a very well-to-do area of London.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that was something I was really fascinated to learn that I hadn't known about, because nowadays you think of Bloomsbury and you think, you know, definitely a sort of elite area and very expensive, huge houses. But at the time when these women were living there, it wasn't really like that. So Bloomsbury was developed over the 19th century. The Duke of Bedford, who owned most of the land, wanted to develop a kind of upper middle class suburb where, you know, big rich families could live in mansions, basically. And the problem was that by the time he'd finished all the building works, any family who could afford to live there wanted to live in West London, which was so much more fashionable. So Bloomsbury became this sort of slightly downtrodden area, and a lot of the houses were empty or sort of turned into slums. And eventually the landlords decided they had to do something about it, so their houses ended up being divided into flats or boarding houses or turned into hotels or shops. And this kind of coincided with a time when women's lives were changing fast and when the professions were opening up and universities were opening. And a lot of women who, particularly literary women who wanted to be writers, were looking for a different way of living and an experimental way of living, or a chance to not just go from a family home to a husband's home, but maybe didn't want to get married and wanted to live independently or with a friend. And Bloomsbury offered a kind of affordable way to do that, and was also very close to the British Museum reading room, which was free and open to all to read and study. This sort of strange architectural era meant that that sort of is why Bloomsbury attracted this kind of literary bohemian reputation that persisted.
It's interesting. It's a literary, bohemian and very erudite and very intellectual reputation. But also, a lot of times we forget that it wasn't just going to the British Library. It was also about kind of meeting and parties and all sorts. There's like a really amazing image in the book, which is this invite to Eileen Power's party. And it says, Eileen Power invites you to a party on from 8:30 to 12 p.m. dancing in the kitchen, colon, morning dress, RSVP please. I mean, it kind of gives you an idea of the fact that, yes, we talk about these women as the radical thinkers, but also there was a lot of fun to be had in these places, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Eileen Power is an amazing character. She's not someone I'd known about before I started researching the book, but I really came to love her. I mean, she's an economic historian. She had studied at Cambridge and taught there for a while, but she moved to Mecklenburg Square when she got a job at the London School of Economics, which was quite a new institution, pretty radical Foundation. It was co-educational, and a lot of her colleagues were very active in the labour movement and in the League of Nations international pacifist movement. So she arrived in London. Her Bloomsbury was not the Bloomsbury of the Bloomsbury set, although they did cross paths, but her Bloomsbury was a really kind of radical, diverse group of intellectuals, of politicians. She knew actors and artists, and they all came to her kitchen dances. But she and her neighbour, R.H. Tawney, who also lived in Mecklenburg Square and is probably better known than she is today, used to invite their students over for discussion groups held probably in the kitchen where they would make pretty detailed plans about the future of socialism in Britain. And I think it was, you know, a time when it felt like those discussions could change society, and she was completely determined that they would.
I hope I could have those discussions in my little broccoli kitchenette. I don't know if I will. But anyway, I just want to conclude. You use a really amazing quote by Virginia Woolf, which is, "Personally, we should be willing to read one volume about every street in the city and should still ask for more." How many books do you think you can write about London streets and about London squares? You know, this is just about one square, and it's a whole book full of incredible anecdotes that hardly anybody will know about. How many books are still out there? How many streets are still out there to explore?
Many, I think. I mean, Bloomsbury has so much literary history and so many stories and so many residents. And I mean, it's a much wider area than I think is generally assumed. It was, you know, much more multicultural than people really realise, much more mixed in terms of class than perhaps it is now. But I mean, far beyond Bloomsbury, there's a lot of London where the history is still to be told. I mean, Mecklenburg Square is perhaps not one of Bloomsbury's best known squares, but Bloomsbury certainly is overrepresented. So we need more.
That was Francesca Wade in conversation with Monocle's Chiara Remella, and her brilliant book, Square Haunting, Five Women, Freedom and London Between the Wars, is out now.
Oh, well, that was the week that was, Tom. I thoroughly enjoyed today's show, ably abetted by your box of Chianti.
Very much so. I always enjoy the weekly because it reminds you what is out there. Sometimes you can be on that locomotive that is Monocle, charging towards the next deadline.
Monocle Express.
And you can stop to fail to stop and gaze out of the window. And look who you meet. All sorts of fascinating people with amazing stories to tell.
I thought all our guests were fascinating. I particularly am intrigued by Robert Eggers. Augustine and I share a particular fascination for weird folkloric horror, folk horror, strange stuff like that.
Can I say the macabre?
The macabre, yeah. But you wouldn't know that as colleagues of you. You wouldn't think that, would you, Tom?
Well, maybe not at first glance.
Would you, Tom?
But having got to know both of you fairly well, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest, Rob.
Okay.
But yeah, I like the idea of the sort of gothic haunting and how that can be sort of reinterpreted for today.
For the modern age.
Yeah.
Bit of Wicker Man updated, Midsummer, Robert Eggers, The Lighthouse. Can't wait to see that. The trailer's weird. I did a sort of films look ahead to this year before Christmas, right here on Monocle 24. And both of the critics that were in the Culture Show studio said, and I certainly couldn't stop laughing at the time, that there's a lot of farting in it.
Oh, really?
In The Lighthouse. And I said, what, sort of, what, for comedy value? No, it's not really explained why they're doing it. They're just doing it throughout the film. So
maybe lighthouse men are like cowboys in the Old West.
Yeah.
They just got a lot of gas to give.
Sort of bean-based diet.
Can you emit flatulence in a macabre and gothic fashion? Probably.
I don't know. I wonder if it takes away from the horror. Anyway, only time and watching the very intriguing
Hopefully.
Lighthouse
no
will tell.
Smell-o-vision or anything like that.
No.
Then you're safe.
Okay, on that bumshell.
That's nice, Rob.
Yeah? Let's thank our pals. That was edition 550, Tom, of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Augustine Macellari, and our studio manager was Maylie Evans.
We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Robert Bounds. Goodbye.